thanks a lot for the invitation. I'm going to be talking about this recent paper with Monica Jika, Ray Song, and Amy Strominger, and probably touch on the second paper here with Rada and Nishioka also. So let me start with a question. That's not a question. There's a question. Okay, so ADS-CFT has taught us a lot of things about black holes and the holographic principle in general. There's a lot of things we've learned. But ultimately, what inspired all of this was classical general relativity. And the black holes in classical general relativity, which do exist and have been observed in the universe, are very hard. It's very difficult to apply the methods that have been used in ADS-CFT to these black holes. So the question is, what can we learn from holography about real-world astrophysical black holes? So the black holes that I'm going to be talking about are the only black holes, as far as we know of, that are relevant in astrophysics, the Kerr black holes. It's a 4D rotating black hole specified by mass and angular momentum. It's a solution of pure Einstein gravity. It's asymptotically flat. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about the extremal limit. The angular momentum is bounded above by m squared. The fact that I'm talking about the extremal limit might sound like I'm moving away from astrophysics, moving away from the real world again. But actually, there are astrophysical black holes that are very near the extremal limit. In particular, there's this one called GRS 1915+105. And just in the last few years, people have been able to measure the spin of these black holes. And this particular one is within 2% of the extremal bound. So
are all observed black holes strongly Kerr? Or I mean, how could it work?
Are they what?
Strong, you know,
highly rotating? This parameter,
J over M squared
is of order one. It's not usually one, but you know,
the
numbers are like 0.2, 0.5, 0.7. It tends not to be very close to zero. And in fact, they spin up because the black holes that are observed are usually in these binary systems and they're sucking in matter from a neighboring white dwarf star. And they're spinning up. So
this is not for galactic black holes, that's more for stellar black holes.
I'm talking about stellar mass. Yeah.
The galactic ones probably are not spinning that much, are they? The quasar cuts.
I don't think we can measure their spin. I'm talking about the stellar mass black holes.
Although people consider that as also.
Can I ask you, since you get these interesting set of questions? So people have claimed to see near extremal spinning black holes from 8 years back. But at that time, nobody believed them. What happened? You know, how did the field develop? Why do I take this seriously?
when people even considering perhaps that the limit might be A equals 1?
No, these were astrophysicists. Yeah. As far as I can tell, they were measuring the same thing, mm-hmm. and they were making very similar claims. But I don't know, when you talk to people in the community, they didn't take the claims very seriously at that time. So I'm just wondering if there's been a culture change or there's been new technology or...
I think it's better simulations. I mean, what this comes down to, so let me describe a picture here. So we're looking down overhead on one of these Kerr black holes. And in an astrophysical one, there's going to be an accretion disk coming in to this line here, this is the horizon. And this is all happening well within the ergosphere. So the way these measurements of the spin work is basically they're measuring the emissions from the near edge of the accretion disk. And what that involves is a lot of difficult modeling of.
But aren't you looking at the rather Doppler shift between one and the other side?
Between one and the other side.
The stuff coming towards you and stuff coming away, going away.
It's not just that.
But then mm-hmm. with.
No, it's also the size. I mean, a big part of it is the total luminosity. So if it's a highly rotating black hole, the accretion disk comes in all the way here. If it's rotating slowly, the accretion disk ends out here, and it's out outside. So for the highly rotating ones, the accretion disk just has more stuff in it because it comes in further. So there's a luminosity and there's a functional dependence of just the spectrum of the X-ray emissions and those two things together.
Isn't it the broadening though of the lines that is essentially what?
There's two different measurements. So one is the spectrum of the iron lines. Maybe that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, right. It's the two sides of them.
Yeah, but the recent measurements, including this one here, don't use the iron lines. It's an independent measurement. It's just based on. It's basically based on some dissipation of energy in the accretion disk as it comes in, and that has some X-rays in both their spectrum fit. Okay, so the last thing I want to point out about the Kerr black holes is at externality they have a Bekenstein-Fock entropy of 2 pi j. And the reason I'm putting that up there is because one of the things that I want to be able to derive is the entropy. So I'm going to give a microscopic derivation of the entropy for these Kerr black holes. Okay, so having introduced this Kerr black hole, let me jump right to the punchline. What I'm going to argue and try to convince you of is that near the horizon of an extreme Kerr black hole, any consistent theory of quantum gravity is dual to the 2D conformal field theory. So the one thing that I'm going to be able to compute about the conformal field theory is the central charge. We'll find C equals 12J. Now, I put the, when I'm talking to the string theory audiences, I leave the parentheses off the word any. I suspect that people here might have a broader, might be more likely to catch me on that. So I'm going to defer any questions on that until I've done the derivation. But let me keep the word in there for now. So the way this derivation works is what I'm going to show is that the states of the theory transform under a Virchow algebra. And in other words, they transform representations of the 2D conformal group. The key points are that we're talking about astrophysical black holes. It turns out that this similar logic will apply to a lot of other black holes too, but what's unique about this is that it does apply to the astrophysical ones. So since we're talking astrophysics, things we don't need, these are things that often come up in specific applications of holography of black holes. A large charge, the internet. Large charge, anti-de-Sitter space. ADS will not make an appearance here. The space-time is not ADS, it's not asymptotically ADS, so this isn't a specific example of ADS-CFT. It's different. No extra dimensions, no supersymmetry, and okay, so an outline of the talk. Start with an overview. Check. The first thing I'll do is derive the asymptotic symmetry group for the Kerr space-time. That's basically the main tool at our disposal for this computation. From there, I'm going to go on to compute the entropy and finally talk about some generalizations and potential applications of the correspondence. Generalizations include charge, Bekenstein space, extra dimension supersymmetry and string theory, all the things that were nice to eliminate, but it's also nice to okay, so let me start by reviewing ADS-3 CFT-2 from sort of a from the perspective of looking back. So the ADS-3 CFT-2 duality explains every entropy computation that's been done in string theory. Basically, what it comes down to, including the first one, the Strominger-Boffer computation of the 5P black hole entropy. So what it comes down to is that in the near horizon geometry of these black holes, there's an ABS3. And if you can understand the entropy in ABS3, then you can understand the entropy of all these black holes. So this was originally done in string theory, and it involved a lot of details of exactly what the theory was, counting the states, getting all the factors of two right, and in the end, everything adding up to give it Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. But what was realized after the fact was that actually all of these complexities that went into it, all the complexities of string theory, were not actually necessary. And the computation basically came down to a symmetry analysis in ADS3. Now, the argument that I'm going to be using for Kerr is exactly it's a very similar argument. So it goes back to this idea by Brown and Anou in the 80s, where they showed basically that quantum gravity on ADS3 is dual to a CFT, computed as central charge. At the time, they certainly didn't word it in this way. They didn't word it as duality. And I don't think that they appreciated the broad implications of what they had done. But looking back in hindsight, you can interpret it this way. So they computed the central charge of the CFT called the gravity on ADS3. And it just depends on the ADS radius and Newton's constant. So I'm going to do a similar thing for Kerr. The method that they use is the asymptotic symmetry. Charles Lauterbach.
It's not that one is completely replacing, at least not that the symmetry group is completely replacing the string construction.
No, certainly not. So, I'll come on this. But the symmetry analysis certainly doesn't give you the details that the string theory duality gives you. It gives you just enough to understand the entropy and not much more than that. Whereas string theory gives you the dual CFT rather than just a central charge. But I'll comment on that because it's true for her too.
The computation was classic at this point.
Which computation? The Brown and Anou computation? It's a classical computation. Well, the same thing's going to happen to Kerr. So object to my computation rather than the Brown and Anou computation. Okay, so I'm going to compute the asymptotic symmetry group of this geometry. It's not the full geometry. I didn't write down the full Kerr metric. I've taken a near horizon limit. So this only makes sense in the extremal case. But the metric that I've written down here, the things to notice are, first of all, that there's something that looks like ADS2. There's a polar angle. And then there's some complicated-looking fiber over the ADS2. And these functions, lambda and omega, are functions of the polar angle. So there's something that looks like ADS2, but there is no ADS2 factor here. It's just sort of appearing. Another key thing you'll notice here is that this probably isn't obvious, but if I were to set this to 1, leave this, then this would actually be ADS3. So adding this here changes the asymptotics of the metric. But there are some things here that are reminiscent of various ADSs. Having an ADS2 is nice because it's going to mean that we have a boundary, but holography in ADS2 is really pretty poorly understood. So just having that factor there isn't enough. Okay, so this near horizon geometry has been known for a while. It has the isometries that it has are U1, rotational isometry. And it has an SL2R basically acting on the ADS2. So, the full Kerr solution, if we went away from the near horizon, it wouldn't have these symmetries. It's been enhanced by zooming out on the horizon. Okay, here's the metric again. We're going to compute the asymptotic symmetry group. So the way this thing is defined is it's a set of allowed symmetries modded out by the symmetries that vanish at infinity. And if you're not familiar with it, then let me just convince you that you actually are familiar with it. The simplest example is a U1H theory. And if you want gauge theory, there's an infinite number of possible symmetries, local gauge transformations at any point. But there's only one single charge associated with those infinite number of symmetries. And that's the charge associated with global phase rotations, gauge transformations that go all the way up to infinity. And that single conserved charge is the U1 global charge of the asymptotic symmetry. So the point is that it's symmetries that go all the way up to infinity, and they're associated with the conserved charges of the theory. So the way that you compute this is you have to impose some boundary conditions. When you impose boundary conditions, that's what I mean by allowed symmetries, symmetries that don't violate the boundary conditions. So you, at this point, you're free to impose whatever boundary conditions you want on how your fields dial from infinity. Eventually, you have to check that you've done something consistent. Once you've imposed your boundary conditions, there's some set of symmetries, in this case, some set of diffeomorphisms, which are allowed by the boundary conditions that you've picked. So you write down all the possible allowed symmetries. Once you've done that, there's a well-defined way for computing all the conserved charges associated with those symmetries. There's standard formulas for this. You can look them up for Einstein gravity. It's basically they're basically Hamiltonian generators. Once you've done that, the tricky part is that now you have to make sure that what you've done is well defined. And what that means is that you can't. You have to make sure that all your charges are finite, and that they obey a well-defined algebra. If you find that you have something infinite, then you have to go back to step one and come up with a better guess for what the boundary condition should be. So the idea with the boundary conditions is that you're specifying when you impose boundary conditions, you're choosing what theory you want to consider. And in different situations, it could be that the different boundary conditions make sense depending on what questions you want to ask. So the business of imposing these boundary conditions is tricky, because if you impose something, like I said, if you impose boundary conditions that are too weak, then generally you'll find that your theory is ill-defined, the Hamiltonian is infinite. If you impose boundary conditions that are too strong, then you'll find that everything vanishes at infinity and your theory is trivial. It's trivial in the sense that every excitation that you can write down that obeys your boundary conditions is gauge equivalent to the vacuum. So in some cases, there's a happy medium where you can impose boundary conditions that are strict enough that everything's well defined, but not so strict to eliminate everything interesting from your theory. So that's the trick in coming up with the asymptotic symmetry group. Once you've done that and you've found something well defined, then you can go and compute the algebra of the asymptotic symmetry generators. That's the group that we're interested in. I should reiterate that this is all classical. This is all completely classical calculation we're talking about. For Kerr, the way this works is, so I'm going to go through the computation of the asymptotic symmetry, but our time is it only takes one slide. So for Kerr, we impose some boundary conditions on the metric. These are just power law falloffs on the various components. I haven't written them all out because it's not very enlightening to look at. But generally, we could imagine that there's some very complicated nonlinear relations between how all the different components of the metric fall off, assuming that the proper boundary conditions are power laws like this is for simplification. And it's quite possible that there's circumstances where you'd want to do something different. Once you impose these boundary conditions, you find the diffeomorphisms are allowed. That was the second step in computing the asymptotic symmetry group. In this case, there's two that are allowed. The second one is time translations. The first one that I've written here is a little more interesting. This diffeomorphism is allowed by the boundary conditions for any function epsilon of phi. And since phi is identified mod 2 pi, I can just Fourier expand and write down a discrete set of generators for the first allowed diffeomorphism by choosing epsilon to be e to the I of phi. So these are the zeta n's. And zeta n's, along with zeta t there, are the full set of diffeomorphisms that are allowed. Now, of course, there's also subleading terms here. If I have a diffeomorphism that dies off very quickly at infinity, then that'll also be allowed by the boundary conditions that I have written this. Those generators, the zeta n's, you can easily compute their Lie bracket algebra, and it's a Virasoro algebra. So this thing showing up here is a Virasoro algebra, so that's the first hint that there could be a conformal field theory structure underlying this. Okay, now that we have the generators, we compute the associated charges. These are the boundary terms in the Hamiltonian, and they're defined as integrals over infinity. Since we're going to gravity, there's an integral over infinity that defines the charge. And what that integral is determined by the action. So depending on what action you have, we just have the Einstein action. Depending on what action you have, you could have a different, you can end up with different asymptotic signature here. Because that'll tell you what sort of boundary conditions are allowed. These things have to be defined. Okay, we've figured out the generators, we've figured out the charges. Now we have to make sure what everything we've done is consistent. It turns out that actually what I've chosen is not consistent. And to make it consistent, you have to impose one additional boundary condition. And that boundary condition is essentially stating that you have to remain at externality. So perturbations in the metric that would lift you above externality, that would bring m squared above j, are not allowed. And this is a technical requirement that we had to impose in order to get things to work. It's quite possible that we just weren't clever enough to come up with boundary conditions that would allow this, that would allow us to go away from externality.
Does that mean there are no non-zero energy states in this decoupled thing?
It means there's no non-zero energy states.
Well,
there's no non-zero dd energy if you define energy as the generator of ddt.
Oh,
but ddt is sort of a funny thing.
You define it as what, ddt minus the angular momentum? But so your Hamiltonian is going to be basically E minus J? I mean, your Hamiltonian is going to be decoupled theory. I'm confused. I'm not seeing what the Hamiltonian of the decoupled theory.
The couple, you mean for the in the sector where we've set this thing to zero?
How do those Virasoro generators relate to the symmetries of the original theory?
Okay, that's a good question.
Or what is m squared minus j in terms of the Virasoro generator? That's what you're asking.
Yeah,
it's probably better.
Yeah, m squared minus j isn't anything in terms of these Virasoro generators.
Uh-huh.
It's orthogonal. Uh-huh. So the way to think about it is that the boundary theory has right movers and left movers, and we've frozen the right movers to be at zero. So there will be excitations.
So it's just a chiral conformal field.
Okay, so
four-dimensional curve.
Four-dimensional curve.
So, what's wrong with the rotations that are not aligned with the axis of symmetry?
What's wrong with them?
I mean, you don't seem to have them among you in general, or do you? The rest in general. Shouldn't you expect to get at least a full rotation for the thing?
So this is an added thing. We've already taken a near horizon one.
So this is.
It's not an asymptotically flat space time.
So this is not. This is another thing, a solution of the Einstein.
This is a solution of the Einstein equations. When you zoom in on the throat, there's an infinite throat in this tumble case. You can zoom in and get a new solution of the Einstein equation, but it's not asymptotically flat.
I see. And the asymptotic limit is in the direction of choices. horizon or as far as infinity?
Which would mean the asymptotic?
Where is the, when you say asymptotic, are you going to very smaller or very?
So this metric here has a boundary at r equals infinity. R equals infinity, and that's where you're gluing on the near horizon. That's sort of far away from that horizon. The horizon is r equals zero, and the asymptotic region of this spacetime is where you're gluing that onto.
So it's at r equals infinity.
Yeah.
Can you say this is near horizon metric?
Right.
Can you define the boundary uniquely or not?
What do you mean?
Because it is 5 gates, we can have a similar boundary geometries, but because conformal group, we have a unique boundary. But in that case,
that's a story. I think.
Yeah.
You mean the surrounding conditions? Or?
Yep. Okay, so we can have a global global set.
You can have the Poincaré patch, and you can have a.
Oh sure, yeah, well, yeah. The same thing happens here. Mm-hmm. It's very important. Okay, so the next step in the asymptotic symmetry, now that we have everything well defined, is, and these are still all classical objects, but we can compute the Dirac brackets. These are classical Dirac brackets. Yeah.
Using the Einstein.
You're
using an action, right?
Yes. The definition of the charges relies on that action.
Which is just so you take the Einstein action.
And there's a theorem that says that when you compute the Dirac brackets of the charges, they have to obey the same algebra as the symmetries that they generate. Okay, that's sort of obvious that had to be the case. But the non-trivial part is that they actually only have to obey the same algebra up to a possible central term. And that's what ends up happening. So the Dirac brackets of the charges, the QMs are the charges associated with the zeta Ms on the previous slide. So the QMs have a Dirac bracket algebra that's a Virasoro algebra, but it also has a central term. And we can read off the central charge just by computing these classical Dirac brackets. Yeah.
So if I would add matter to this discussion, then your charges would get a matter contribution.
That's right. If you chose boundary conditions that were sufficiently strong on the matter fields, then it wouldn't change.
Then they would drop out of the charge, the definition of your symmetry.
That's right, yeah.
Or even out of the expression for the charge generators.
That's right, yeah. Yeah,
Because if they would still be there, then they might modify your central charge.
Right.
They just come, but they only modify through the definition of the stress tensor. They only.
Right.
The Qs are built out of the boundary stress tensor.
Yeah, but actually out of the what is going to be the boundary stress tensor, but in terms of the block theory, it's some integral or some metric.
Yeah, the Qs have a contribution. For instance, if I do this in Einstein-Maxwell theory, which is also good done, then the Qs are some function of the metric on the boundary and the gauge field. And if you allow the gauge field to go all the way out to the boundary, then it could contribute to the central charge. And you have to be careful and check that it doesn't. If you want.
But that would be effectively like giving a charge, making it a Kerr Newman.
Right. Actually, in Kerr Newman, it turns out that there is an extra contribution, but it doesn't contribute to the central charge.
That's the classical one.
I mean, this is all.
Yeah. So, okay. When I get to this equation, I haven't said anything about quantum games. So now I'm gonna claim that I have. So the claim is that this semi-classical computation of Dirac bracket algebra in a quantum theory should be quantum. These should be quantum commutators, And therefore, what we've actually shown is that quantum gravity on this space-time is dual to a 2D conformal field theory. So we found it here Sauer algebra. That means there's a 2D conformal field theory. Now, there's something a little more to that statement. So as has come up in the last couple of days, holography, if you allow the boundary theory to be anything, then holography is sort of a trivial statement. It's just a statement about differential equations and how the boundary sort of encodes what's going on in the bowl. The boundary has to be something interesting, like a local quantum field theory, for holography to be an interesting statement. And what makes this powerful when the boundary theory is a two-dimensional conformal field theory, what makes this powerful is that the QMs can actually be interpreted as the Fourier components of a local boundary stress tensor. And you can use them to build back up a local stress tensor.
One of the reasons for why the boundary theory would be local is because anything that has finite size in the AES, once you transport it to the boundary, becomes a point. So what happens here?
You're saying does the volume and area scale?
No, not the volume and the area. The fact that are the redshifts, is the boundary infinitely big compared to anything in the interior?
It is.
But is the boundary, is it how many dimensional is it?
That's a funny question here.
But it comes to
what?
It seems essential, right?
I mean it's two dimensional, but it's two dimensional in a different way than what would happen in ADS3. In ADS3, you would try to scale near the boundary and you would find some really big thing times two-dimensional flat space. Here, what you find is it sort of looks like it's pinching off into something that's one-dimensional, and you have to rescale things to make sense of it as a two-dimensional thing.
Purely chiral CFT is a quasi one-dimensional thing. I mean, all operators in the theory depend only on a single coordinate.
So it is some squeezed boundary. It's 2 plus 1 dimensional, but in a squeezed way, so that most things only propagate in one.
Right.
One dimension.
Right. Okay, so the central charge that you read off from doing these classical Dirac brackets is 12J, which is the angular momentum of the black hole. So the claim here is that we've shown that there's this duality. And in particular, if you believe that we have this is really only for extreme black holes, but if you believe me that near extreme black holes are approximately dual to CFT, then and I can't really justify that, but it seems reasonable. In that case, I can tell you that this astrophysical black hole GRS 1915 plus 105. Is approximately dual to a two-dimensional conformal field theory with a central charge of 10 to the 79. So I don't have any intuition for what that means, but it's fun to plug in numbers.
So besides the symmetry argument, do you have an argument why there has to be really two-dimensional field theory?
You mean why it should be two-dimensional at all?
No. Okay, we do have symmetry.
Yeah.
And then from there, you conclude that there has to be some two-dimensional field theory. But I think there is a B in this logic.
Sorry, so what's...
So the system does have the symmetry.
Yes.
That automatically imply that there has to be a field theory, that is, there has to be a symmetry.
So, I'm sort of defining a 2D CFT to be a quantum field theory that has states that transform onto the 2D conformal.
No, it's more than that. Somebody else already defined a two-dimensional conformal field theory. It's more than that.
Right. So it is more than that. But what it is that's more than that is this local is the fact that I can construct local stress tensor on the boundary. I mean, I've already written everything that I've written is a boundary integral. So in that sense, I've given you something that lives on the boundary.
Right. And then the existence of an OPE, you know, closed OPE and the subrules and so on fall automatically?
I don't want to give some libertarian. But I think it would follow. I'm still confused about the theta direction. No. So okay.
The theta direction is like the S bar.
It's like the S bar.
Yeah.
So in the CFT, oh, sorry, the CFT has operators that are classified by their functions that
yeah.
decomposed as.
Yeah.
I'm still not quite sure. The existence of a local stress tensor in the SRO algebra means that the stress tensor satisfies the right OPE, but does it prove the existence of other primaries in the theory and the existence
of once you have a central charge, it's a unitary theory, of course there are other primaries, and there would have to be local operators again because of this argument that asymptotically, there's this one plus one dimensional thing that's growing.
That's the stuff that I think people are not clear on.
Now, if you look at the metric, I think there's an R squared.
So, most in ADS correspond to local operators, the boundary that the argument?
Yeah, it's basically working the same as AAS safety. I mean, there. I'm just talking about gravity here, so there are no motionable. Or sorry, in AAS 3, if you're talking about gravity, there are no motionable.
Could you briefly show the metric again?
Yeah.
So there's the R squared in front of the P squared. And then the theta remain finite on the boundary. At least the defi squared. Or
to rescale.
You have to rescale defi.
Theta is like the S5.
Theta is like S5.
Although there's some kind of warping in it. I mean, your omega and your lambda are both functions of theta.
That's right. Yeah.
Is that dependence held rigidly? Is that part of your boundary conditions? I guess so.
No.
No.
No. Okay. All the boundary conditions are just power law follow-ups.
Okay.
Lambda is not a function of R, is it?
No. Nothing's a function of R.
It is a function of theta.
Right.
But that's a bit funny. So the
right.
So the length of the phi and the fall depends on
right.
It's squashed.
So it gets squashed.
It's okay. At a particular theta, it's squashed ADS. Or squashed ADS is ADS 3 written as a phi over ADS 2, and then you change the coefficient of phi.
I think it's not a good question. I mean, to ask about the central chart that the next sheet. I just recall there was this subpaper of Martinek from many years ago when Andy was doing this in the context of the 5T black hole, which showed that this central charge, even though formally it looks correct, is not the actual central charge of the neural theory which shows up as the boundary theory of the diffeomorphisms. Because the neural theory has a funny way of defining central charge because its ground state doesn't start from the vacuum energy being equal to zero. The ground state energy itself has a shift, and finally you come back to getting C only equal to 1. Instead of having 1 plus
C. So you're talking about sort of the C effect if it shows up in the
particle. Right.
Yeah.
Right. There was some story about which I don't remember very well, but it somehow showed that the naive C you might expect on the basis of this argument is not what actually shows up as a C for the diffeomorphism group in the boundary neural theory.
But the boundary theory isn't a neural theory.
Yeah, there's more to it than that. Yeah.
No. There isn't even a neural theory at all.
Yes, so I don't know, what's the story there? Does anybody know that story? What was Martinek, where did Martinek show that time? He showed the C somehow wasn't the C you would expect.
I think that question comes down to more how are you going to represent this particular.
Well, the vacuum is normalizable.
kind of where you don't know if it's UV or not.
The vacuum is normalizable and the central charges on right and left are unequal. It is not neutral.
Yeah.
There's a discrete spectrum, which means it's not neutral. The vacuum is normalizable, which means it's not neutral.
If the left, the vacuum is normalizable, what?
Okay, there's a discrete spectrum, which means it's not neutral. The left and right central charges are unequal, which also means.
How do you know the vacuum is normalizable?
The spectrum is discrete.
Do you know that?
I'm not sure how much we know yet.
Okay, I mean, the fact is we don't really know anything about the CFT, so that's sort of
yes, we do. We know that the spectrum is discrete, because in a purely chiral CFT...
It's not necessarily purely chiral. So
okay.
I've only showed you, let's say, the left motors. So I've only showed you the left motors. I'm not claiming it's a chiral CFT.
Ah, because I think you said it was before.
I'm only examining half of it. I'm not claiming it's chiral. So I basically fixed the right movers, if there are any, so they're ground state. Okay, so that's the asymptotic symmetry analysis. The thing that I promised to prove in this correspondence was the entropy formula for Kerr.
Okay.
And to do that, we use the Cardy formula. The Cardy formula for a CFT, we need a central charge, which we have, and we need a temperature. So where does the temperature come from? Well, at externality, the Hawking temperature is zero, so it looks like there's no temperature for us to deal with. But actually, there are variations at externality that you can define temperatures for. So if we fix the externality condition, we have M, J, and I've added a Q electric charge in here because the formulas look a little silly and trivial without it. And if we just take extremal variations, then we can parameterize them in terms of two of these and write DS like this. So DS is DJ over something, that's something I'm going to define to be T left, plus TQ over something, that's something is TE. And these are the potentials for extremal variations. And you can derive what they are just by looking at the formula for the extremal entropy. So that's what we've done. For Kerr, the extremal entropy is just 2 pi j. So straight from that formula, we can read off the temperature conjugate to j is 1 over 2 pi. And the formula in this case is pretty simple, or looks sort of trivial. But in the case where you add charge and so on, these formulas are pretty complicated, and you can find some temperature. Another way of saying all this is that if I take a scalar field and I stick it on the extreme curve and ask what's the vacuum state, the answer is that it's not in a pure state, it's in a mixed state. But instead of being mixed with respect to energy, it's in a mixed state with respect to angular momentum at a temperature T left. So if a little j hat that shows up here is the operator.
You simply postulate that this is your quantum state.
No, I'm not postulating that. So this is the Frolov-Thorne vacuum. I'm sure this is the Frolov-Thorne vacuum.
Yeah. So it's a choice of vacuum.
It is a choice of vacuum.
Yeah, it's a choice.
So I've lost track. This is a real temperature, and then I can convert it to one with units.
Units.
I'm just afraid you're telling me that temperature that I want to associate with this thing is the Planck scale.
Now it's omega h set by the frequency of the rotation.
Set by what?
Omega h by your frequency of growth. Isn't that how you normalize?
I don't know.
Let's see. So
T sub L is omega h over T sub h.
Why are we talking about this? You're talking about the entropy. Why are we talking about temperature? You're like microeconomical and stuff. Talk about mass.
He wants to define density.
Why should I talk about mass?
Then simply because it changed
change that theory.
If you talk about entropy, if you talk about energy, if you talk about
I'm taking a, instead of taking an ensemble the way you would with energy, I'm doing it with angular momentum.
Yeah. We could give this another name. We could call it.
We could call it energy too.
We could call it the angular velocity which would be maybe, isn't that what it is? In the normal way of
So you're still fixing J, just to understand, you're still fixing J to be a given value. You're taking a spread such that the peak would be at the value of J you want.
So
you're making a state which has all possible values of J instead of taking states for the given J. So it's just a choice.
That's
you could integrate on the other one also in principle. Or the ensemble actually comes out this way. The safety state is well defined only when you have this J defined in the as a spread.
This is a choice that's this is a choice that I'm making because this is the choice of quantum state that people like to talk about on Kerr. When this agrees with what Phil and Thorne have done all the time ago on Kerr, and it's basically a Hartle, it produces a Hartle.
Since J is a conserved quantity, I could also do something very microcanonical and actually try to just fix it, right? But then I don't get any real safety.
If you try to change the analog of mass which J, you're changing the theory because you're changing the simple trap, counting different states in the same thing.
I'm talking about putting a scalar field on this space time. I'm not talking about an ensemble of black holes.
This is another scalar field on the same space time.
And you're basically the same, well, the time in this region is more naturally identified with T equals the angle. And this is e to the minus beta h, but then h being the generator of rotation.
Right.
But
should one take h?
Maybe you could say that again. I mean, before you were writing formulas like m squared equals j, implicitly there are Newton's constant in that, and you set it to 1. But somehow that set of units isn't what you're using here, so I don't quite understand.
Okay,
you try one more time.
So the units again. So let me think about that.
I think physically it's what I said. It's beta times the angular velocity. Beta is a length, and the inverse temperature is a length. The angular velocity is an inverse length.
It's
a basic dimension.
Or should be temperatures and not temperature. So he's talking about height of the sky should be temperatures, not temperature. TL, so it's the ratio between the entropy and angular momentum, both are dimensions.
Another way to think about it is that you start with a mode that has I omega t minus plus I phi in the full Kerr solution. Then when you take a near horizon limit, it has e to the I n right over t right times you can just rewrite the mode numbers in terms of near horizon quantities. And when you do that, you can say, okay, well, we started with something that was in a typical Hartle-Hawking or Frohlich-Thorne type vacuum and just take the extremal limit, and this is what you get. And since I've gone into coordinates that are, since I've gone into coordinates that are dimensionless, so are the sort of these things.
So if you can set Q to 0 and M squared to J, that is what you have to be considering. How do the THTL, TE are related to each other?
probably there should be only one scalar in the problem. TH is zero. Yeah. Right. Okay. Cool.
Because you're only considering purely extreme.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so in terms of the kind of thermal wavelength, it would mean that one thermal wavelength would fit exactly once around the black hole.
Yeah, I don't think that there's anything very radical. The state that we end up with is sort of stuck. Okay, so we have a central charge, it's 12J, we have a temperature, it's 1 over 2 pi. What do? Plug into the Cardy formula, and when we do that, out comes 2 pi j. So the Cardy formula reproduces the macroscopic entropy of the curve. Now, I have pulled a bit of a fast one here. So let me go back and reconsider the assumptions. So for the claim that quantum gravity on this space-time is a CFT, the assumption that I used was that there's some consistent UV completion of quantum gravity. And in assuming that, I'm assuming it has a semi-classical limit as gravity on the space-time. So that doesn't have to be true. But that's the assumption for this statement of the Kerr CFT correspondence. To be able to claim that we've computed the macroscopic entropy, we have to use the Cardy formula. And the Cardy formula makes some assumptions about the CFT, in particular modular variance, which I simply don't have an argument for. So I have to take that as an assumption. And generally, when we use the Cardy formula, we also like the temperature or the level of the CFT to be much higher than the central charge. So I assume that 1 over 2 pi is much larger than 10 to the 79. And clearly, this is sort of a sorry state of affairs. In strength, so I can't completely resolve this. There are other examples of Kerr CFT correspondence applied to other black holes, where this problem does not happen, and the central charge is much smaller than the temperature. But for this particular Kerr case that we're interested in, I can't give a resolution. In string theory, what happens is that there's an effective description, that there's a similar problem in string theory when you try to apply a Cardy formula. But there's an effective description where the big factor in the temperature the big factor in the central charge migrates over the temperature. And in the effective description, it makes sense to use the Cardy formula. So we can hope that there's something similar here. Let me not.
If you see, there will be some symmetric product.
Right, with twisted sectors. Yeah.
One question on the previous slide you had. Can you just go back one? If you actually want to get the entropy from the central charge and the temperature, there's an extra factor of 2 pi, which corresponds to the length of the circle on which the CFT lives. You need, so the actual formula is, there's something with CLTL, then there's a C by 6, okay, there's a 1 over 6 or something, and then there's the length of the box on which the CFT is living.
So that's been absorbed into T.
Okay, so I'm a little unsure, how do you absorb the length of the, okay, on, I can define a CFT on even an infinite line with the given T, right? T
is, I mean, you can't put an R in here, this is already mentioned, so I,
so this formula works. When I was reading your paper, I found if you put the length of the box to be 2 pi, this is correct. But I was wondering, where did that go in that the box length was 2 pi? That's, it doesn't come out from central charge.
You're saying there's an R over 2 pi.
Well, R is the length of the CFT box, yeah. I was wondering at what point got fixed up that R was 2 pi.
No, that's the periodicity of phi.
Is that from the periodicity of phi? Because phi is your box? That could be the answer.
That's
where you
work. Okay. Yeah,
I think
that's
how we absorb it
to
the
temperature. Okay. I have a stupid question. The formula they use for the Cardy formula is the tangent to go like C times the square root of the energy. If you try to go to a temperature, you don't get that if the equation is C drop up.
Sorry, what?
If you start
from the square root of C times E,
yes.
That's the same as this.
Can you do the transformation?
What?
Can you do this transformation between E and T? Can you do C?
I mean, that's exactly the same issue, because ENT, different mother's unit of the actual space length permission safety lives, like, because temperature tells you the amount of energy per unit length in a space, right? In this room, there's some energy per unit volume because of temperature. But to know the total energy, you'll have to know the box size. So if you want to convert from E to temperature, there will be a factor of box size somewhere. After that, you can convert it.
But are you talking about box size? You're talking about the factors of C.
It's a factor of C. Oh, sorry.
Right. Right. Right.
Pardon?
Right.
That's a different question.
It's the right formula.
In terms of
the temperature.
So between E and C, there also is a temperature. That's true. Yeah, if you convert from E to T, there will be a factor of group C.
Yes, I get that.
Yeah. But I think it works. I don't know if I'm checking for that paper. Mm-hmm. You know.
If we eat just
because T is just a temperature, there are many, many degrees of freedom. They all have contributed to the energy, right? Just entropy normally at group C.
Yeah. The energy
entropy in terms of energy is root CE.
Oh,
I guess the very root. Entropy is root CE. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
I think it's just when you think of the energy density in the Mills theory, there's a factor of mc squared. That's all you're saying. When you're talking about this conversion, you just mean. Write down the energy density in a thermal bath.
That's right. That's all.
And there's a power of T, there's an energy in this factor.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So here the length of the box wasn't there, so I just want to work well for 2 pi of the ice. Okay.
So we computed the entropy modulo some funny assumptions. So let me go on to talk about what we can use this correspondence for. So first of all, let me just talk about this entropy computation. So as Herman was pointing out at the beginning, this kind of symmetry analysis has good points and bad points. The good thing is that it applies very generally. We can apply it without knowing what the CFT is. We certainly don't know what the dual microstates are. We've only counted. So that's a good thing. We can do that without knowing the UV completion of quantum gravity. And we can do that without worrying about the details. The bad thing is that we don't know anything about the CFT. So the question to ask is, what can we derive not really knowing anything about it? And the kinematics of a two-dimensional conformal field theory are actually very constrained. So there's actually things we can learn about it. Well, we've learned the entropy. There's this analogy this nice analogy that Schrödinger likes to use the entropy, which is that the original string theory calculation for the entropy is a little like deriving thermodynamics based on all the details of chemistry, periodic table, knowing everything. But really, that's not what you need to derive the laws of thermodynamics. All you need is scattering. You need some idea that things are made of atoms. And the symmetry analysis is sort of the Statmak version. Instead of the periodic table version, laws of deriving the laws of thermodynamics. Okay, so let's go on. This takes me to sort of the more speculative things.
Can I just comment on what you just said? In some sense, one may also get the feeling that this kind of calculation using diffeomorphisms is in some way, which I can't clearly see, a repackaging of the derivation of entropy, which you anyway get by, let's say, the standard methods, where Ward has put them into the following language, that the entropy of a black hole is just the Noether charge for diffeomorphism in the time direction. You know, the normal derivation of entropy can just be written down as the Noether charge for time diffeomorphisms. This is also using the same diffeomorphism structure of the Nye space-time. They're actually looking for the microstates. There may be some simple reason why one guy gets packaged into the other in these cases with the symmetries. In which case, one is just going back from gravity to gravity, and there might be some reason why it had to work.
Okay, you're going from gravity to gravity, but there's still something non-trivial here, which is that I don't think you're going from gravity to gravity. I mean, you're still showing that there's a 2D conformal field theory.
No, that's true. This is a very special case with a lot of extra structure. But I think that it's still possible. The reason why this is working is because for some way which I can't clearly see, because you're still using diffeomorphisms as a metric. In this case, it might reduce to what Ward would call just computing the noise and charge for time diffeomorphisms.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has to give the same answer, so
True. So answer was cheating on because I know it gives the same answer. I'm saying it's the same thing. But some of the inputs are fairly similar.
If it were the same thing, then I don't see why we couldn't do this for the most general possible horizon.
Absolutely.
Okay.
If it was the same thing, there should be
something. That would be great. That would be very much.
Yeah. Going from the central charge to state counting even takes a lot more than just the symmetry algorithm.
I'm not saying that I can see the full connection, because we're not putting in the actual details of the CFP, like you're saying, you would actually use a periodic table details and so on. So the arguments are purely within gravity. And at just one stage, you bring in the G as a division, 1 over G Newton, to get the right number. The similar thing you have to do in the Ward computation, where at the end you just get a classical entropy and divide it by G to get the actual quantum number. So that way, there are some similarities.
But you're definitely using something about the dynamics, because for some CFTs, it's not even
true.
For Newville theory, it doesn't work. You don't get the right state.
Because if the real thing doesn't work, well, that's what Martin was saying, was some trouble with doing this, but I don't know what the trouble is.
Well, it's not my real theory anyway, so don't worry about it.
Okay, so just briefly, I can add back in some of the things that was nice to avoid, but we can learn something from doing that. So there was the 4D curve, that's the one I talked about. We can add back in higher dimensions. We can do this in asymptotic ADS space. So I don't have anything very interesting.
What changes? Does anything change?
All the formulas change, but nothing else. The answer still, the method still goes through, the answer still works.
But what do you mean? You take a Kerr black hole in asymptotic ADS,
yeah,
and then take the near horizon limit.
That's right.
And then in the near horizon limit, the ADSness still survives.
Or it solves Einstein's equations with the cosmological
constant.
Yeah. But they do some funny rescaling. the little lambda goes, doesn't go in front of the big lambda. Meaning you're rescaling. Doesn't scale out the.
No, that doesn't scale things out. No, it really, the near horizon metric really looks similar, but it sort of has all the same pieces, but different functions of theta and functions of the house model of constant and so on. So, yeah.
Can I ask in higher dimensions? So there's. Am I supposed to interpret that as I expect that there's a higher dimensional CFT? But what they did is they organized certain sectors of the CFT so that each one looks like a chiral two-dimensional CFT. It's just in there. There's
the boundary is still sort of effectively two-dimensional. The boundary of the near horizon region has sort of a compact thing. Still sort of running a two-dimensional.
But didn't they identify sort of a CFT and a central charge for each one of these symmetry angles?
Yeah, they did. So I think what wasn't clear in this paper that I cited here was that you have to pick one or the other. There are not, okay, so I'm sort of getting ahead of myself here.
Okay, if you're getting ahead of yourself.
I have a slide, I probably don't have time to get to it, but maybe we can talk about it. Okay, so asymptotic ADS, I don't have anything interesting to say about it, but certainly it's intriguing, the idea that at infinity, you have, let's say we do this in four dimensions, at infinity you have a three-dimensional conformal field theory, somehow on the horizon you have a two-dimensional field theory, so I don't know what's going on there. You can add charge, you can embed this in string theory or supergravity, and the hope in these string theory constructions is that you might be able to learn something about what the CFT is. Although I think at this point it's still not a whole lot anymore, except that it works. Okay, so now moving on to sort of work in progress here. I said that we wanted to be able to compute some things with this correspondence. And going back to the early days of ADS-CFT, the natural candidate for something to compute is scattering off black holes. So these are some of the earliest computations that ended up turning into ADS-CFT. And Kerr, the natural question is, how does the CFT encode the decay of the extreme Kerr? So the extreme Kerr has zero Hawking temperature, but it's not supersymmetric in it, so it does decay. It decays via these super gradient nodes. And the way the super gradient nodes is that there's a little m here is the angular momentum of the mode, and omega is the frequency. And there's a certain range of frequencies where a near horizon mode has negative energy according to an observer at a fit. So this is sort of the wave analog of the Penrose process where you can extract energy from a black hole. And modes that are within this window, where omega h is the angular velocity of the horizon, modes that are within this window are spontaneously radiated in super radiant decay. And you can actually compute analytically the gravity answer for super radiance at the far ends of this bound. So that's what we'd like to be able to understand with CFT. At the lower end, this has more or less been done in a general way about 10 years ago. And the answer is that the decay rate is basically a two-point function to CFT. But CFT is creating some bulk nodes that are going. And that computation agrees, but it's sort of a trivial power law, and we don't see much imprint. We don't see much imprint crystal too. So the other thing we want to understand is the other end. For large omega, the upper end of the super radiant regime, there was this computation done in the 70s by Tucholsky and Press, and they found this long and complicated formula that I've written here. I'm not going to define everything. My point is just that it's not a simple power law or anything. There's a complicated formula for decay of these modes, and it's not at all obvious how this could possibly come out of CFT, what this has to do. So this is basically what I want to say about it. This is work in progress, and I think that we can get this out of CFT. So there's sort of the belief that since we don't know anything about the CFT, we can't do anything. But it's not quite true. We do the entropy, and my claim is that we hopefully are going to be able to do this very light stuff too. Okay, so let me just say very quickly about this other thing that's work in progress. So there's a natural question that's already come up a couple times, which is, what about the other half of the CFT? And in terms of the black hole, the question is, what about the dual question, is what happens when we try to move away from externality? So I pointed out that there were technical reasons that we're unable to do our computation away from externality. But I still want to ask this question, what about moving away from externality? And to remind you what happens in ADS3, where there's two SL2Rs, the isometry group had a left moving piece and a right moving piece. And each of those extended to a Virasoro algebra, asymptotic. So the asymptotic Virasoro algebra contains this one has this isometry subgroup, this one has this isometry subgroup. For Kerr, what I showed you was that the near horizon isometries have a U1 and an SL2R. And asymptotically, we got a single Virasoro, which contains the U1. So the U1 extended to a Virasoro. But over here, we have this sort of SL2R staring us in the face, asking, what about me? And the question is whether there really is a second Virasoro on the right, the way there was in ADS3. And I think the answer is yes, but I can't prove it for you from the asymptotic symmetry group. The evidence that I do have is that if you assume it is, then you can compute the near extremal entropy. So this is the only evidence I have for this claim at this point. let me just skip this and skip right to the summary. The summary is that although we've only talked about one half of the CFT, we're not claiming it's really a chiral CFT. We're just claiming that we've only talked about half of it. And in other words, we've fixed the right movers in their ground state. So we set T right to zero. That doesn't necessarily mean there's no interesting dynamics on the right, because at least what happens in string theory examples is that they're in the ground state, but there's fermions on the right. And the ground state is actually a filled Fermi C. And the dynamics of the Fermi C are what lead to interesting things in super radiant decay of black hole. So even though we don't know much about the right, I think it can certainly come in and do us something interesting. Okay, let me skip that and jump right to the summary. So I've argued that gravity on the extreme Kerr is a conformal field theory. Did this without doing anything exotic. So the key point here is that we can apply this to astrophysical black holes. Like I keep bringing up GRS 1915, central charge of 10 to 79. So.
How near to extreme low is this?
What?
How near to extreme low is
this? It's 2%.
98%.
Yeah, 2% away. But it's not clear what measure you want to use. So it's 2% in terms of J squared and M. But why is that the expansion parameter? I don't know. Maybe the expansion parameter should be distance of the accretion disk from the horizon, if you want to ask questions about astrophysics. And in that case, it's less. So the open questions that I mentioned were moving beyond extremality, which we have this sort of numerological coincidence evidence for, but nothing hard at this point. And the other thing is calculating things in the CFT. So I talked about gray body factors. The other big question is whether we could do astrophysics using conformal field theory. There are interesting things happening. Astrophysical Kerr black holes that are happening near the horizon, accretion and X-ray emission that we can observe from Earth. So we will hear about that from Herman Wano. Okay, and then of course there's the really open questions, things like what is the CFT and what have we really learned about the microstates? So we counted them, but like I said, the CFT isn't accessible in this kind of argument. And in fact, it depends on what UV completion of quantum gravity we pick. So if there's some way to put string theory on that, on the near horizon curve, then that could be a different conformal field theory than some other UV completion of quantum gravity curve. They would just have to agree on the central charge. Okay, let me stop there.